Ken Kelman, and I'm here with Ellen Boughton, Sierra Smith, and we're going to be talking with Dave Hogg, who was on the NRAO scientific staff from very early years in a variety of capacities.
And it's March 26th, 2013.
Thank you. Dave, you first came to NRAO as a student.
Yes, that's right. I was a graduate student at the University of Toronto. My professor there, Donald McCrae, was a colleague of Gart Westerhout. And Westerhout and McCrae had created a table for the conversion of galactic longitude 1 to the new system galactic longitude 2. Back when it was difficult to do that because of the absence of computers. So they knew each other that way, and Westerhout had come to North America, I guess eventually to get a position, but this was after his thesis was published with the Westerhout grouping of sources. And I was slated to help build a radio, solar radio observatory in Toronto and then latterly in Algonquin Park. I'd done a master's degree in swept frequency observations of the sun. I wasn't all that enthusiastic about it. My other professor was Alan Yin. I took an electromagnetic course from him too. And Westerhout came, and he was coming to Green Bank to begin observations at high frequencies using Drake's traveling wave tube radiometer at 8 gigahertz as a new system. And Westerhout was going to do spectral indices and detailed mapping work in these two regions. But McCrae arranged that Westerhout invite me to come and watch him observe. Well, I came down to Washington for the Spring IRSI meeting, which was held in April in D.C. in those years. I attended that and then rode with Finley and Emerson to Green Bay, stayed in the Hill House and watched Westerhout try to observe at 8 gigahertz.
So what year was that?
1959. After that, it seemed that it was a good thing to try it. McCrae said I could do a thesis in the H2 regions. I did W3, W4, and W5. W3, of course, has since then achieved some notoriety. I like W4, which is IC-1805, a big region, which I postulated had been swept clear by stellar winds, but it was only later that that, I think, proved to be perhaps correct. In any event, I did those, I mapped them. So I came back to Green Bank at least three times, mainly using 85-foot, 140-foot, of course, was not available, and the 300-foot was not either. In the later years, I did a little H1 work, but mainly it was a continuing mission from H2 regions. I finished all the observing in 1961, I guess, and finished my thesis in draft form in the summer of 1961, accepted an offer of employment 1961 fall. I had a visa to come to work, and it was for the summer. My wife Carol at that time was pregnant, and there was some urgency to get here. My thesis wasn't going very well, so I called the consulate and said we couldn't make the time for the visa. He said, I'll just put it in the drawer, you call me when you want it, and I'll issue it again. That was the way it worked in those days. And that happened. So I came without finishing my thesis, and I worked for the observatory and finished the thesis.
As a
staff appointment. For, I suppose it's incorrectly called a postdoc. It was a research associate, that's more.
Oh, was it?
Well, I think it was a research position. We didn't have postdocs.
Yeah, it was a research associate.
Yeah.
Was that what you had, or was it assistant scientist?
Oh, no, it's research.
Oh.
It says assistant scientist.
Yeah.
This must be right. Came from the... Yeah?
That's an important question that we did want to ask. You know, whether... Whether people immediately went into staff positions or whether... And by the time I came in 65, people were...
Or postdocs.
Coming in as a research associate, right?
Yeah.
Including myself.
I can't remember.
Yeah. Well, this must be right, though.
Well, I presume I got it. I was getting those things accurately.
Right.
I didn't. So I guess there were no postdocs, or at least I wasn't. And then I finished my thesis and graduated formally in 1962. The production of the thesis was a problem because the university wanted a number of copies and the observatory wanted some copies and it was hard to do. So in the end we decided it would be typed on the copper sheets and put into the printing type pseudo printing machine. And so it put a premium on typing accuracy. Because whiteouts don't work on copper sheets very well.
I'm not even sure if whiteout has been invented then.
I don't think so. So I hired a secretary from the observatory. Close associate of B.D. Sheets. This was a young lady, Joanne Rose. And she was really, really good. So she'd come in. I would go down to Slaty Fork, which is outside Cass, back in the halls. I mean, she was back in the halls, trust me, at that point. And this was through the winter. I would go down and get her Saturday morning, bring her up. She typed for 3 hours, and her boyfriend, Brooks, who was an engineer in the works area, would come pick her up and take her away at lunchtime. So that's the way the late fall went. And finally, it got printed, Carol. Collated, we had it all laid out on the kitchen table. The kid was crying in the background. She'd walk around the table.
But you were on the staff then, an employee?
I was on the staff, employee.
So
yes.
Did NRAL pay for this typing, or did you have
I
to
paid
do?
For it.
Hmm.
My thesis. She was working Saturdays for me.
Right.
That was a private deal. Her sister, by the way, she was really quite striking. And the young men tended to follow her down the hall. And this guy Brooks ended up marrying her. And sadly, I was devastated. Sadly, she died when she was 40 years old or so. It just broke my heart. She and Brooks had gone off when he was working somewhere. I don't know what she died of. I assume cancer or something. Her younger sister, Sandy, who was a computer person here for some years, married Al Braun.
Of course, yeah.
And resides now in Socorro.
Right. So you partly answered one of the questions I wanted to ask about why you came to Greenbank, or to NRAO. NRAO is a U.S. National Observatory.
Right.
I was going to ask if you thought about, or McCray had thought about, any other place like Caltech. When did you say you first came? What year?
1959.
So by that time, Caltech had a 90-foot antenna.
Yeah, but I don't know that they had a visitor policy.
Well, that was part of, that was a question. Did NRAO was originally established for U.S. scientists to bring them into the modern era. Was that at all a constraint or at the time? Or
I don't know whether it was constraint for Heeshan and latterly Struve and Berkner and those people. That was slightly above my pay grade. They didn't discuss that with me. For me, the border was transparent. I was back and forth across because my mother was American.
Westerhout, at that time, was still visiting from the Netherlands, or was he already in Maryland?
I can't tell you that. I thought he was visiting from the Netherlands, but I suspect it wasn't long thereafter that he came to Maryland, and he may already have been there.
But anyway, your coming was more or less a private deal.
My coming was the first instance was a private deal with Westerhout McRae.
Yep.
And that showed me the place. But the second time when I started my thesis work, of course, that had to be done properly and approved by NRAO. I put an observing proposal in.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. That had nothing. By then, Westerhout was out of the pictures between me and Heeshan, basically. So they were interested in starting a student program.
You still have that proposal by any chance, or the letter? Or how extensive was it? Do you remember? Just a letter?
At best, a letter. It may have been a phone call from the crane. He should pop up. It was not quite as formal as it is. But it was an agreed upon thesis proposal. And de facto, NRAO kept an eye on me because McRae was never here.
Right. And you used NRAO instrumentation. You didn't build anything
Correct.
Yourself.
Correct.
And that was...
Well, it was primarily the 2170 Uinday 21-centimeter receiver, or continuum. And I'd have to look up my thesis, but I had some 10-centimeter stuff, I think. I tried the 8 gigahertz thing, but it was kind of interesting to look back now, as you say, of course. Back then, there was a huge friction between Westerhout and to some extent Drake, whose receiver it was, and the technical staff, because the receiver was never as stable as Westerhout. He was badly disappointed when he came in there. It was never as stable as he thought it was going to be. And the quick answer was that none of us appreciated how significant the water vapor was in the clouds.
So it was at 8 gigahertz.
At 8 gigahertz, all atmosphere. So these lads would come out and they'd work the receiver and they'd do their low tests straight down the page and they'd hook it up and point up in the sky and start going bang. And Drake would cuss and Westerhout would cuss and they'd storm off.
And who finally appreciated what the problem was?
I don't know who. By the time I was doing stuff, you knew that you better get a nice day. Have luck with that receiver. But I'm sure Drake finally, he was doing his Venus stuff.
I think it's important if it was somebody at NRAO as opposed to elsewhere.
I can't tell you.
Yeah. Was Mark Vinokur, wasn't he involved?
After the fact.
He did quantitative measurements or something.
Well, he wasn't there during any of this time. I don't think he was there when I was doing my thesis. I probably saw him the first time, maybe when I came in the fall of 1961. I'm not even sure if he was there. He was certainly not there. My thesis people were Menon, Wade, Roger Linz.
You say your thesis people, these old people thesis. Helped you or advised you?
Yeah. And actually, I was kind of really shocked when I came back. Roger had a Grayback publication map of W3, which is my thesis. So I had to do a little fast shuffle.
This existed when you came, or came out after you came, or
it came while I was
right
in the process of my several trips here.
So who else was around then? You mentioned Wade, Menon, Drake,
Heeshan,
Finley.
Bottom at some point. Before 1962. I can't remember Sebastian when I first got to meet him when he first came. Hugh Johnson. Can't remember when he was there. Struve, during the time I came, Struve came as director. He wasn't when I came with Westerfeld. And Struve brought Linz and Beatty, and Beatty did her famous Sky series, Dark with Bright Clouds. Much of that work was here, working from Palomar.
Sorry?
Working from the Palomar prints. That's where she did. I forgot which was which. I guess she did Bright. These two regions first and then the Dark Clouds. But Linz, da da da, is the famous Dark Cloud, the da da da, has done molecular studies in. So I believe it was that Dark Cloud survey that was done on the Struve Waltz was here. Miss Ness, Struve brought her as principal assistant. She morphed into being a librarian after Struve left. And then there were, Mary Jane Wade. I guess she had basically assisted Struve, but I can't remember what. And Struve had a couple of collaborators. If you look up papers by Struve at that time, some of these collaborators would parachute into Green Bank. They'd knock out a paper and parachute back out.
This is unrelated to radio astronomy generally.
In general. One of the guys that I really was impressed by was a fellow called St. Temesvari.
Oh, yeah.
Really a bright guy. And he taught, I believe, at SUNY Albany. And he and Sebastian and a couple other intelligent guys wrote this book on star formation back circa 1960. That was a really great little monograph. I think these may have been prize essays. I can't quite remember. One could look that up. But this St. Temesvari guy was a contemporary Sebastian. Came to see either Struve or Sebastian or both. And he was, what a gracious, warm, smart guy that fellow was.
Excuse me for interrupting, but in transcribing other interviews, Sierra and I agreed that all proper names should be spelled out, because when it comes to transcribing it afterward, you can't. So Thomas Severi. What was his first name?
I can't remember what his first name is. The last name is St. Thomas Severi. S-T.
Oh, that's his last name. I thought that was...
No, no.
Yeah, go ahead, spell it out, please. You can't.
I can't. No, we'll have to look the book up. No, what his first name was the German equivalent of James or John or something.
I thought Saint was his.
No.
I thought Thomas Severi was his last name, because I did meet him. Anyway, when you're here as a student, you're here alone.
One trip alone, one later trip with Carol.
Right.
And a third trip alone.
Okay.
I think I had three trips for my thesis and one with Westerhout. I was probably here four times. I was here twice a year until I had my thesis that I'd already done.
So you were in here being Green Bank.
Yes.
You were in Green Bank both as alone and with your family.
Yes.
Can you say something about the personal relations between you and your family and the local Green Bank people?
Yeah, well, when I was here alone, I was here alone. I had no relations with the local people, except for those that worked at the observatory. One time I was here, and it was probably the summer of 1959 to 1960, was a time of great storms. So we had a border one 50, 180 inches of snow that year. And it happened that these storms were falling towards the end of the work week, and the roads would be closed because they couldn't plow them fast enough to keep them. So the chief field foreman for the 140-foot and I were in the residence hall. And that was hard shifting because the people couldn't get to support the residence hall. I would keep the fire going and all that stuff. And he wanted to go back to Detroit, which is where he lived on the weekends, but he couldn't ever get out because the roads were blocked. So that was one of the deep relationships that I formed. He was a very interesting fellow.
But he wasn't really local.
He wasn't a local at all. He was from Detroit,
right,
man. When my wife was down with me, we had no children. We lived in the Low Farm, which is Whitlow's house that was grandfathered under the agreement until the death of, I think it was his mother. And when she died, then the house would revert to NRAO. The summer before we came, it was occupied by Robert Fleischer, who was from, at that time, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, was here to help us establish a summer visitor program in astronomy. As I remember it, he and I didn't really overlap much. And then he subsequently went on to fame and glory in the NSF. I moved into his house with Carol, and we inherited Whitlow's mother's chickens, which we raised with a kind help from Trent Storr, could advise us on the kind of feed that we had to get. Carol and I not being well-versed in animal husbandry at the time. So we looked after the chickens, and when we left, with the permission of the observatory, we gave the chickens to a friend in the community that we had developed. And they were only good, they were scrawny hens by then. They were only good for stew chickens, I think she told us. So we lived there, and we still mainly, that was Kennedy election. So we went to the election party at Lynn's house, as I remember. There were relatively few televisions then. Television was a art form, and in the radio observatory, we had very spirited discussions. I think the consensus was that the Golden Crossfire Yagi was the one that could get you two or three stations, but you had to have it on a rotor. Anyway, so we were quite good friends with Beattie and Roger Lins. The Drakes were very kind to us. They lived where you would know it as the Fomonts, where they lived that little house back in the cottage in the woods. Eastons were very kind, and Rife was quite kind to us. We knew the people from the store, Trent's store. There wasn't, of course, a Henry's back then, but there was the store on the corner of the Recreation Grounds Road, and they were pretty reserved people. I mean, they were civil, but they weren't warm, so we were Trent store people. And we had a good relationship with Clarence Sheets. He looked after our cars for us. But it wasn't until we lived there that we started to know the local.
Elaborate on that after you started you lived there a while.
Well, once we lived there, we had kids, we got into the school system. Second time we lived there, Carol became quite active.
Second time being
1970. She got into garden club, and they had plantings around. Our kids were in their local Green Bank Elementary School. By then, it was at a high school. I forgot when the high school got combined. But in any event, she was appalled. So she offered to paint the school for them. And so she did. And she put this R on a lot of, I don't know if you had a paintbrush or not, but I sure did. And a lot of the observatory people, Board of Education gave us to paint the brushes and sent us to it. Her, one of her strong memories, this was an old school. Ceilings 12 feet, 14 feet. In the upper grades, when you're washing with these, painting with these, you had to paint over the tobacco stains, the chewing tobacco. I was amazed how the kids could do that on a 12-foot ceiling.
This is the elementary school or the high school?
Well, it was one and the same at the time,
right,
but I can't remember when the high school kids moved out. Whether in 1970 the high school kids were still there. When was Pocahontas?
57.
When was Pocahontas High School built? I was there the inaugural year. It was sometime in the 70s, 74 time.
It was while I was there, certainly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was there for the inaugural year in 1970, 74, sometime in there. So whether it was at the start or the end of that period, I can't remember. But that there may have even been seniors in that school still when my kids started there first.
So what other interactions did the staff have with the school? People taught?
No.
No.
No. AOI gave money.
Right.
The tall engineer was still at Mr. Coral Mary and Bill Brundage. Mary Brundage taught music. Eventually, Michelle taught after West Virginia decided that they could accept provisionally the California education system and the license. And Michelle still had to take qualified courses.
No, she had, I don't think she had any educational training at all.
Wasn't she a teacher in California? Oh, okay. I've colored that story. Whatever. I was always blown away by this bureaucracy, not accepting a California system graduate for its teaching program. But it's typical of the way they run their business. They have the highest standards for barbers, masseuses, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, almost impossible to get a license for that in that state. Yeah.
That was more of a protection of the
it was something that somebody, I mean, follow the money. You have to follow the money.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a side issue. I don't mind being quoted on it, but it's a side issue. It's got little to do with astronomy. Back to your questions.
Were the schools a consideration in leaving to come to Charlottesville?
Minor consideration. The schools, my son started the older in grade probably 4 and the younger in grade 1. And when they came back to Charlottesville, they moved seamlessly into the Alamo County system and, in fact, were better prepared than their counterparts in terms of reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Yeah.
They had a little band, but not much, and they had zero Latin and the other stuff like that that were hard to obtain. We weren't at high school level. Had we been at high school level, that would have been a very serious consideration. But why we came back, we missed the larger city with its conveniences. The towns were nice, they were small, friendly, but they were small. And 55, 60 miles to get a decent grocery store, get a decent medical situation, that's too much. I had lots of, you must have too, lots of times in those mountains in the wintertime. I had studded tires, I had chains. Carol slid off the road into a pond, and that was really bad. Times you couldn't drive.
Yeah. Aside from your own experience, So you must have been around when the whole discussion came up with the thoughts about moving to Charlottesville.
I was.
Not you personally, but...
I was.
Yeah.
I was around,
yeah.
But not part of it. So Carol remembers a famous board dinner in which she was nonplussed to, as board person after board person would come up to her and basically say, so how do you like living in Greenbank? And
do you remember what year when this was?
No. I mean, it was close to the decision time. But that decision was going on at a level above my pay grade. So we knew it was happening. I did not know of the tension between Robbie and Heeshan. That was never discussed until after the fact. I did not know that there was even serious consideration of such a remote place as Princeton. It would have been really hard to operate the observatory from there in that day with the communications systems we had, be it road, air, or line. I'm not sure that other than for political reasons, West Virginia, the university, was ever a serious challenger. I don't know that, but I don't. So.
Well, was it discussed among the staff, A, do we want to move somewhere, and B, where?
At my level, there was desultory discussion, but the serious discussion on those two questions was upstream.
I see. So the staff was never really involved then?
This staff person was not. That's not, I mean, to ask Wade or somebody like that, whether he and Mary Jane were.
Well, you were all young. I mean, you were all...
No, he was... He was quite a bit older than I because he had done military service.
Right.
And he had graduated. I mean, he went to Australia in 1958 or something with his PhD. So he was 3-4 years ahead of me in PhD plus 2-3 years of Army. So, no, we weren't on the same age. He was a very tight colleague, respected colleague of Heeshan's. So when I say it's not a frivolous suggestion,
yeah.
I want to ask Wade because... He was much more involved in the observatory management than I was.
As you know, we've talked to Dave Heeshan.
Yes.
About it, but it'd be interesting to get the perspective of the staff. So let's go back to the relations, working relations among the Greenbank, both the scientific staff and the, called the support staff. So, Fred Cruz was there and Omar, Boyer, who else? Who were the other key players?
First three or four telescope operators were Fred, Omar, Bill Meredith, very important. Troy Henderson, very important. Then the next kind of wave, Howard Brown, Bobby Vance, Bobby Vars, one more.
Sorry, who?
One more. So there were eight, probably. They had a radio engineering background. So I think both Omar and Fred Cruz were at radio stations. I believe that to be true. I've forgotten about, George Grove. Don't forget George Grove. He had had extensive technical training in his military service. He was also at MIT, but did not graduate from MIT. But he, I learned my electronics from the Bureau of NAS Ships Electronics Guide for Technicians, which you must know, and which was the handbook in 1957-58 circa for anybody starting out in electronics. You had to have that book. It was a great book. It was designed to teach untrained technicians how to maintain shipboard radars, gunnery control systems, and things. So it went all the way through amplifiers, closed circuit, loop circuits, servo systems. Just it was a great book.
What was the title?
Bureau of NAS Ships, Bureau of Navy Pacelli. I can't remember.
The book title?
No, I'm grasping for it.
It was a soft cover.
Yeah.
8x10 format. There's a whole series of them.
800 pages, 600 pages.
Yeah. And it was for non-academics, so to speak.
Electronics, naval electronics, but I don't know what the title was. I don't even know if I could put my hands on it. I think it was Bureau of Math Ships and some strange thing.
I think I still have one or two of them. Not that particular one. But
that one of the series.
On transistors or something, I think.
Yeah. Anyhow, so Grove was well-founded in that, and some of the other guys, I'm sure, were. So they were important, and the works area people were important. So Paul Devlin was kind of the site officer. He did everything around the site.
And that was a bit later, wasn't it?
Well, he was there pretty early.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, he may have been the... He may not have been there in 1959, but he was around a lot of time. I got to know of telescope operators, the Gum brothers were there. One of my memorable moments as a student.
He wasn't an operator, he was a
client. So one of my memorable moments was sometime in that period, but in the winter, maybe the first winter I was wintering. Heeshan said I should go and set the panels on the 85-foot telescope. So I can't remember the months, but it was winter. Trust me, it was winter. I can't remember the temperature, but it was certainly below zero. And it had to be a clear night. They didn't want to do it in the sunlight. So I and Sidney Smith, who was running the theodolite, I was there to see the process and approve the process, check them out. And Basil and Mackie Gum were there to turn the screws. And you stood up there in the dish at midnight with, let's say, zero, maybe 10 below zero. I'd come from Canada, and you'd say, well, that's good. I looked at the latitude, and it was subtropical. So I had my winter top coat, but not my, I had flying boots. Flying boots that I used when I observed in the telescope on Richmond Hill. But I did not have them there because I was going to D.C. and spring blossoms, cherries, you know, the bit. I'm standing in kind of regular shoes on this metal surface, which is a heat sink, just pulling the heat out of your body. And the guys who were dressed properly, they were getting in half an hour, they were so cold they couldn't work. So we'd work for half an hour, we'd go down to the control building. It was just agony. I got so cold, it went right into my bones.
Well, I can verify that, Dave, because I did the same thing with Wade on 140-foot in August. And it was, I thought we were in equilibrium with the 3-degree background. It was cold.
Nasty job, yeah. But the bonus was the Mackey boys, no, not the Mackey, the Gum boys, plus probably one of the other climbers would entertain us with stories. So Mackie was sure that he had seen the abominable snowman and lived up near Snowshoe. But it was so cold. But mainly it was a telescope operator.
So the people on the scientific staff,
yeah.
To what extent did you have what we now call functional duties, particularly when you came, when you were hired? Did you have any responsibilities?
Well, when I came, my functional duty was to get my thesis.
Yep, right.
Right? To avoid embarrassment. Very shortly thereafter, yeah, I had functional duties. So Heeshan, when the 300-foot was about to come online, assigned people to use the 300-foot. So was it then? Was Ivan there? Somebody had to do point sources, get calibrations. I and Johnson, Hugh Johnson, were doing extended galactic sources. So I started doing supernovae then. And so on the one hand, it was to get supernovae papers. On the other hand, it was to understand the telescope. And it wasn't shortly thereafter, 63 maybe, that he formed an interferometer group.
Yeah, well, we'll come to that. We want to spend a lot of time on that. But
I would say 61 to early 62, I had to do my thesis. 62 to 63, I was doing 300 foot under an assignment from Hessian, specifically.
Assignment to work on the calibration and commissioning, or to use it?
To use it.
Science.
To use it? Well, both.
Both.
I mean, yeah. to use it for science, you had to commission it.
Right.
There was no arbitrary separation.
Like the same thing, 140 foot,
yeah. So, but I was offered the opportunity to use the 300 foot to study supernova remnants. So I took it. Let me make you an offer you can't refuse.
Do we know what responsibilities other people had?
Well, Linz had gone by then.
Yes.
Drake, I can't remember.
Well, scientifically, he was doing planets.
Yeah, I can't remember if he ever did.
Millimeter.
Oh, well, yeah, he had gone out somewhere and met Frank Lowell, and Frank Lowell got the treatment. So Frank was doing his millimeter stuff then, yeah, but not on the big telescopes. He had his own telescope system. Menon, when he was there, he got into a mode of oscillating. You know, and when he was there, he was doing 300-foot galactic sources. Linz was doing H2 regions. I've forgotten who was doing extragalactic sources.
Ivan.
Ivan was there by then, wasn't
he? Well, Pliny, Toth, Wade, and Hessian.
That's right.
Yeah, that project on 300.
That's right. That's right. That's what it was, yeah. Sebastian was there, I can't remember which years, and I can't remember when he got so involved. It must have been a bit later in the occultations of the Crab Nebula and other sources. He developed, in a Sebastian-like way, this elegant theory of occultation analysis.
Did he do it?
Well, the Crab Nebula.
I'm trying to remember, did he do any 85-1, or is it? I know he did it 140 foot.
Yeah, it was.
I think that was the first. In fact, I think he had the first scientific observation on 140 foot even before it was finished.
To do an occultation.
In May or something, yeah.
Yeah, the crab was being occulted in 64 or 65. And it spurred a lot of interest in that technique.
And what about Struve? We've heard a lot about him.
Yeah, he was very much a bimodal guy. You read Osterbrock's book about Yerkes, and you see the Struve that most people know. Man of absolutely iron, high standards, rigid, tough. The Struve I knew was not that guy. The Struve I knew, well, to begin with, I didn't know him that well. And he had also changed somewhat. He was in failing health. He was burdened by the problems of 140 foot. And he socialized with the women. So my wife was, in order to, neither one of us could work because we didn't have visas.
When you were a student?
When I was a student. That was when I got to that student desk. So neither one of us could work, and yet we were there and they arranged that we have a house, but the house had rent attached to it. So my wife worked off the rent by assisting B.D. Linz in the observatory library. So she became one of the women. So Linz, Mary Jane, Carol. There was this other lady with whom he wrote a book, and she was in residence.
Oh, yes. Starts with a Z.
Zoltovi? No, that's the wrong. Yeah. But anyhow, yeah, that lady. So they would kind of wander off. He would come by and take them off to coffee, and they'd talk about the most recent Maryland Monroe building. Excuse me? Struve? Pocket Home? Yes, that's what he was into. So he'd go up to Columbus Circle, the AI meetings, and go see the most recent Marilyn Monroe movie. But we saw him just a little bit. Of course, he was writing his Sky Telescope articles. We were all reading them because you had to read them. That's how you got through graduate school, was to read Sky Telescope Struve articles. And I do remember one time, 1960 plus or minus, when Minkowski wrote an article, probably about Cygnus. And Struve had read it. I don't know whether he saw a pre-publication copy in his position or what, but he came into the coffee. He would sometimes go and, well, he'd do ladies in the afternoon, he'd do the staff in the morning. We'd all go for a coffee, we'd do science. That was a good, and he, boom, and the stuff flew off the table. That Minkowski, I will smash him like a bug. And it was over this Cygnus article or something.
What was the issue? I mean,
I can't remember. He was just livid. He thought Minkowski got the science wrong or something.
Colliding galaxies.
Maybe it was colliding galaxies. Anyhow, that was the one time I had ever seen Struve like the old Struve. He was very sharp. He hadn't lost his edge that way. Just physically, he was tired.
He wasn't that old by our standards.
His body was.
Well, he had a tough life.
He apparently suffered in the detention camps.
Right, yes, I mean. But aside from the morning coffee.
Well, there were
interaction
the AOI meetings.
Yeah, no. But I mean, interaction with the staff.
Not with this staff. I mean, you have to understand, there was a distinct pecking order.
Ah, there was. I mean, because this, you know, one imagines this is a small group in an isolated, usually that kind of environment reduces the impact of rank. And
it depends on the issue, doesn't it? Yeah, so we would talk science. Heeshan was the director of the scientific effort. Struve was the director of the observatory into 140-foot.
So it was Heeshan was the main interface.
Yeah, so did I talk science with Heeshan, Drake, Wade? Yes. Did I talk science with Struve? Much less so, because my intersection, cross-section with him was much less. Did Drake and Heeshan talk science with Struve? I'm sure they did. But with Struve was a hair professor. I don't care how small or big the group was. He was a hair professor. Heeshan wasn't.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know about Bolton, but Struve was a hair professor. And hair professor, that term carries a certain protocol. And that's the way it was. So not even a graduate student, right? Well, a graduate student, but not a postdoc. Hey, there are other low forms of life that I don't choose to associate with them either.
So he brought the European traditions with him.
To some extent. Now, he was forced by circumstance. He had such bright lieutenants, Drake and Heeshan, Finley for that matter, that it couldn't all be do it my way.
I remember Finley was hired by AUI. Is that right? You remember?
I believe that's correct, yeah.
Robbie.
By
yeah, but who?
No, he came.
There was some personal relationship.
He came in November of 1958.
Before
no,
or
wait.
After Struve? Before or after Struve?
Wait, no, earlier than that. November of 1956.
Uh-huh.
Oh, before Struve.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, no,
definitely
no, before Struve. It could well have been President Berkner through the atmospheric connection, because Finley had some knowledge of atmospheric business in England, I think.
A comment on Project Ozma? What you knew, when you knew it?
Well, I certainly knew it. There was no secret about it. Struve made an important support of it at a critical moment. I didn't know that at the time, but it's subsequently been, I think, quite well documented that he was a very strong proponent of trying it. I did go to the briefing which Drake held for the telescope operators, which the confidential nature of the project was discussed, and I was absolutely critical that they not blab their mouths about it. So who was there? Well, I don't know, Omar, Fred, probably George Gold.
Sure.
But had you, you know, discussed the project at coffee, just casual way, or
a little bit, but nothing that stayed in my head. So I was surprised when Carol, I was talking to Carol, I was here, Carol was in Toronto, and the CBC had an article about Project Osmo, and she didn't know anything about Osmo, but she knew it on Greenbank. So she, when I talked, she said, what do you know?
What's going on?
That was about it. There were, after the fact, were there reporters? I can't even remember that. Whether Drake had one or two tame guys that he gave information to, I can't remember that.
It wasn't thought of as a big deal, or I mean, was it a just another observing project?
No, it was more than that. But it was recognized that this was a very high-profile thing that had a lot of public interest. I can't remember when. When did we burn the highway in New Mexico? That was before Osmo, right? What's the name of the famous town in New Mexico that has the...
Roswell.
Oh. Roswell. Well, Roswell was pre-1961, right?
47.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, so the public was attuned to this topic. And we were savvy, we, the observatory and the AOI, were savvy enough to appreciate that if this thing were not properly managed, it could go nonlinear very, very quickly. So, yeah, it was not just another look for another H2 region by some graduate student.
Okay, I'm about 140 foot, so we know a lot about the problems.
Heesh's
written about it, and so on.
I have very little to add to it. I mean, it was always there, one stage or another. And as I say, the guy whose name momentarily escapes me, he was the first contractor, but the successive ups and downs of it were known to the staff. And it was an unhappy time.
I mean, were you chomping at the bit waiting for it?
No,
because,
I wasn't.
Because
I
was it was
not.
Critical to your research?
No, absolutely not. I had the 300-foot come, would I have been? Well, I think it's, again, fairly well documented. The observatory would have been in deep trouble with the 300-foot. But as it was, 300-foot was a frontline instrument. Slow? Yeah. Good? Yeah. Got some good stuff out of it.
As far as your own research opportunities, that was...
That was it, yeah. And it wasn't long before we were into the interferometer. Yeah, I mean, the two-element interferometer got going before that 140-foot, didn't it? 1964?
I don't know. I came in 65, so I don't...
Was it running then?
Yes.
Yeah. Was it 140-foot?
Oh, right. It was just being finished.
Yeah. So the interferometer...
That's right. The interferometer was running first.
The two-element.
Two-element,
yeah. We'll come to that. Okay.
What do you remember about the first outside visitors? You must have been one of them, I guess.
I think I was the first PhD student, thesis. I think I was the first NRAO thesis. I don't remember much. There have been some familiar names, so I wasn't there much in the summer. Whether it be design or accident, I don't know. But so I missed the famous summer student. I didn't know Fomalhaut. I didn't know Dickel. I knew of their reputation afterwards. I didn't know George Field. I didn't know the summer visitors because I wasn't there.
No, I meant visiting observers. At what point did NREO become a major user facility as it was designed to be, as opposed to being used by the resident staff?
It must have been after I showed that it was possible to do a thesis there. I'm sure it was it.
I'm not talking about theses so much.
I wasn't either. I was just...
Okay.
I would... There. My memory is that there weren't all that many visitors, but after all, think of it. The 85-foot was not that much better than what was happening in California, maybe Illinois, certainly Michigan, even Harvard with the 60-foot. So there wasn't that draw. I remember clearly Burke bringing the after the 300-foot, and began perked up. Burke brought his DTM correlator, DTM spectrometer.
Multi-channel.
Yeah, to the 300-foot to do H1 stuff. I could think about it, but right this instant I can't think of other observers, but I'm sure there were some.
NRL.
The NRL guys, yeah, they were on the 300-foot. I don't remember many people doing the 85-foot.
For the reasons you said.
Yeah. NRL, when did they get their Maryland Point Telescope? It was contemporaneous.
Well, they were frequent visitors when I was there, starting in 65.
To the 140-foot.
Both.
And the 300-foot, but not 85.
Nobody used the 85 after 140 photos.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
As a single one.
Right.
So
it wasn't a philosophical objection. Or
right. Yeah, no.
Who?
Trying to establish.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to
At what point NREO fulfilled its role?
I would say the 300 foot.
Yeah.
That attracted a lot of. It was so large a gain and competence.
And how much support was given to the visitors?
Well, the telescope operators, obviously. You had to be there. There was no question.
Some people brought their own equipment. Front ends, even. Like NRL, I think.
Yeah, that wasn't... Certainly with time, it became less and less. Now, Bonham and I built our own front end to do Jupiter polarization in 1967 or sometime like that. See. Put it on. I kind of thought we had it on 85-foot.
67, you said?
Yeah, that's why I'm confused. Yeah. Whether we had it on 85 or the 140 or both.
And you actually participated in the hardcore.
Yeah.
Good, yeah.
Yeah. So I must say, I bet you it was before 65.
I think it
must
have been.
But as soon as cryogenic receivers came, that was the end of guys like me fooling. Now, people, I won't say nobody brought front ends, but it was unusual. You had to be technically quite strong to...
Well, the NRL.
The NRL, for example. Yeah.
But around that time, then, NRL began to assume the full responsibility for antenna, receivers.
Yes. Stop. So... We said that any competent radio astronomer should calibrate and reduce his own data. And the only competent radio astronomers would pass through our rigorous proposal system. So therefore, in the syllogism, there was no need for NRL to provide software or calibration support. And it was a tenet of the faith, one that I endorsed completely, even to some extent still today, that the observer has to assume the responsibility for his calibration. And back then, pointing was an invention. And receiver temperatures and gains were an invention. And not only could the staff not guarantee them, but they couldn't keep up with the changes in time. So the observer had to do his calibration. And after that, well, it was a big breakthrough when we got an autocorrelator. And we decided that the visitor couldn't do the Fourier transform of the autocorrelation, a valid assumption in retrospect. And so we had to have an autocorrelator reduction program. But it just spat out profiles. You were on your own after that.
Who developed that software? Vance?
Who?
Bobby Vance? I mean,
No.
We didn't have a...
Well, I mean, Art Shalloway did the basic...
Hardware, certainly.
Hardware and whatever equivalent of float...
Firmware.
Yeah.
Vance was the only... software person.
No, there are people here. This was after, I mean, we got really serious after Charlottesville. So we had guys.
Oh, somebody here.
Well, I'm trying to think of whether it could have been George Conant.
That was later, I think.
Okay.
Ganesh Shalloway.
There's no doubt that Vance understood it and maintained it and kept it up and all that stuff.
But
heavy duty processing was here.
Yep.
You know, they'd send the tapes here. We had this big processing.
Right. But that meant that in order to use the NRAO facilities, you had to be a more or less black belt radio astronomer.
Or be trained by someone who was. There's this problem about whether students like me could just come into the town, and the answer was no, they can't. They have to come with somebody who'll show them around, or make arrangements with a Kellerman or a Fomont or somebody to tutor.
I mean, this meant that somebody in Minkowski, for example. Come and use
no them. Prayer. So that became part of our institutional duties, particularly with the interferometer. I can't speak so much about the single dishes later on because I was full time. So I would, and Jelmy and Wade would do students. So we did Frank Bash and all the early students of the interferometer.
I mean, the interferometer required a higher level of black beltness.
That's probably true. I will tell you just because I think it's an interesting reflection on radio astronomy. So when I came with Westerham, he took the strip chart and a ruler, and he measured the heights of the bumps. When I started my thesis, I was really happy because the NRAO technology had changed, and they had an analog to digital converter, which took the chart signal and turned it into numbers. And I no longer had this, actually, I've forgotten if I had to do the really ruler bit for a while or not, but most of the time I didn't have to do, I had numbers that I could work with. And so you do the scan, and there were the numbers. And they were printed out on a batch tape, the same kind of thing you'd see in a grocery store checkout, so this thing would come up in the measurement. It was like a revolution. You take the batch tape, you date it, say what it was, and there was your thesis sitting on a roll basket. But that wasn't good enough for the NRO. We're very interested in cutting-edge technology. So instead of printing it, they got themselves a teletype tape punch thing, and they fed this number in, and so they got out these punch tapes. And that was even better, because we then eventually got a computer that could read these punch tapes. So, you know, I first sat writing the numbers down. There was a big red chair in an 85-1, and you read the A to D converter, and you write the numbers down. That was my first operation. Then you move to this tape, so you could tuck that in your pocket and you go on. But all the time, you had to somehow get this into the computer. Well, then we had a paper tape. You get it into the computer. Well, that was pretty cool, except that the particular teletype machines we got were a little less reliable. And so occasionally they would screw up. And you knew they screwed up because they always had a checksum on it that said whether they had a check error or not. And if they had a check error, the paper reader, tape reader stopped right there. So what you had was you had your printout, right? And you had your paper tape, and you'd see where the parity error concerned and what number it was they had missed. Then you'd look around at the paper tape to find that same number. You'd fiddle on the printed tape. You'd fiddle the paper tape till you found that number. You'd read that one number, and then you'd put it back in, and you'd go along for a while. And if it happened only a few times an hour, that wasn't too bad. But when they went bad, it would happen all the time. And then you just went back to keying the numbers and yourself off your paper. That was astronomy in the good old days.
Anything else?
Saving interferometry for
yeah,
next time.
Yeah, I think I'm going to do the interferometer and, you know, leading into the VLA. Probably wait till next time for that.
Okay.
Sarah?
Is there a difference in culture in your experience from coming from Canada to the United States in radio astronomy?
Well, there was no radio astronomy culture per se in Canada. The Canadian students interested in radio astronomy as such, with only one exception, all went to Cambridge or Manchester. Maybe a couple to Australia, but mainly Cambridge. And so some of the names, you know, Canadian radio astronomers for the first generation were trained in England by far. The exception was me. I don't know where I would have gone had it not been for this connection. I might have stayed. When I finished, there was still no radio astronomy in Canada as such. So to work in radio astronomy in Canada, I might have gone with Covington in Ottawa with the Solar Group if he had a job, I'm not sure. But I had a nice job offer here, so I just went. The difference, people would ask, Carol particularly, well, you've left Canada and gone to the United States. It must be a big difference. And she would say, yeah, it's a huge difference. In Canada, I was living in a city of 1 million people. In the United States, I'm living in a city of 75 people. That's a big difference. And that was the cultural difference, was that when we lived in Canada, that was a big city.
Were you offered the job as opposed to applied for it? They just say, well, you know, why don't you come here on the staff, or did you ask? Or?
No, he initiated
yep.
it. But yeah, I can't remember. It began as a conversation.
Right.
And I suppose, well, I must have had a letter to get a visa. But it was...
That was a formality.
A formality.
Okay.